You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Harriet Mullenwitz. It's good to have you here this morning, Harriet.
Thank you so much.
We're doing a kind of a quick transition here. And so the way we start the show is with the big question, who are you? And I know you've been listening to a few shows, so
I've been sort of binging on them, yeah. Which has been fascinating. I realize there's two different ways, at least, to answer this question. One is by the descriptive abstractions, and the other is by some of the facts. So I'll start with the abstractions.
Okay.
I would say neurotic, intense, judgmental, an introvert who many perceive as an extrovert, intellectually driven, emotional, eccentric, quirky, and still insecure at the age of 61. I would also say I do not live in the moment. I know you're supposed to, but I live very much in the past or the future in my head most of the time. I'm kind of ADD without the diagnosis, self-diagnosed.
Yeah.
I'm very deeply a writer, an atheist, a conflicted activist, always a lover of language and literature. I'm not really comfortable in most places in the world, and I'm ecstatic when I am with those people that I'm comfortable with and who I really communicate with. And I hate small talk and chit-chat. It makes me crazy. But I love and crave really great conversation, or at least my idea of really great conversation, which always involves some degree of personal openness and intimacy and analysis, and more finally honing and articulating perceptions, and usually with people being open about their insecurities. That provides some of the best conversation.
Vulnerability.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
I'm talkative.
Yes, and you're organized because you had notes for this.
Yeah. I wanted to gather my thoughts.
Yeah, and that is part of who you are, and on this show we want to honor that and explore it, I do less of that. I do less note taking than I used to, and less note bringing. But it was a real decision and a real weaning for me to make that choice in my life.
Why?
And it's not everybody's. Because when I had 25 boxes of files from courses and work and writing and stuff that I just didn't need to have with me anymore, I was ready to let it go, and I was ready to let the lifestyle go that accumulated that. So for me, I wouldn't just prepare, I would save it. You know what I mean? And I needed to just let stuff go.
Well, that was very courageous of you.
But as a friend of mine will say, I'm not always good at it. So I try. Anyway, so Harriet, thank you for the introduction. Where would you like to go musically now as we start this conversation?
I'd love to start with a song by Silvio Rodriguez, who's a Cuban singer-songwriter, who I listened to this album, Rabo de Nube, constantly in the 80s. And in honor of Obama's recent trip and the recent opening up of our relations with Cuba, let's hear his song, El Día Feliz Que Está Llegando.
And you want to translate that.
A happy day that's coming.
That's coming. The happy days are coming. Yes.
Se está arrimando un día feliz. Como hace un barco tras sus meses. Se está acercando un día de abril, se va a arrimar a los finales de noviembre. Y yo me apego más al mar, mi hermano doble de los peces. Siendo leña en el hogar que vio brillar la tempestad que guía el curso de estos meses. se está arrimando un día de sol. Se acerca un pájaro feroz, zumbando al goce de tu olor. Se acerca un tiempo de conejos. Y a mí me escarba la ansiedad. Me escarba hondo acá en lo blando. Me escarba.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Harriet Malinowitz. So Harriet, one of the ways that we launch into a deeper conversation is what experience has helped to clarify or shape your life? Experiences have helped to make sense of the purpose or the wanderings of your life?
Well, I guess to preface the story of something that really changed me, I grew up very, very apolitical. I read the newspaper less than anybody, even in my class at school in Queens, which was a very provincial, uninteresting place at the time. It's changed since then. And I'm now a very, very political person and care extremely about social justice and human rights. And this is connected, to my ambivalence about community activism, which I can get to at a later point. But basically, I was raised in this sort of middle to lower middle class area of Queens, where most people had more money than we did, and the emphasis was always on marriage, children, living in a Jewish community when you were older, celebrating holidays. And I developed a real false consciousness around these things. I just believed that that's how the world was and I must want these things too. But it turned out I didn't want to be married. I still don't. I didn't want children. I was a lesbian and I still don't want to marry my partner, even though I can. I was an atheist and I was forced to go to the Hollis Hills Jewish Center and Hebrew School, which poisoned my little mind and turned me into an anti-Zionist. But that all really came much later. That change came much later. When I was 21, I traveled one summer with a young French leftist named Francois, and we traveled in France and Italy and a little bit in Switzerland. And I knew him before slightly, but I had no idea what I was really in for. And we were hitchhiking around, and we met all these people who were young French and Italian leftists mainly. And they all jeered at me for being American. And I had no idea what they were talking about. I had never thought of myself as an American before. And I had never thought about what Americanness meant to anybody outside of my little world. And Francois used to say to me constantly, "You should get out of Queens Village." I would say the most outrageous things, actually. And by the end of that time, these were some of the most painful but yet important weeks of my life, I think it was just a life-changing experience in terms of especially seeing how other people more or less my age saw the world and related to it, as opposed to the people I had grown up around.
Wow. So it's a two-part process. It's being growing up in an environment that's too precious by half, and then finding that begin to crumble. How did the crumbling lead to your emergence as a person?
Well, partly the crumbling was exciting because life in Queens was really boring.
Uh-huh.
And it promised all kinds of things that I didn't really want.
Right.
And suddenly I discovered that life was full of alternatives and the world was just much bigger to me. And the interest in politics really started with just the realization that there was a world out there. And, you know, there's the old cliche, like in some political circles that we, or in labor studies, on we're actors in history. And I remember when I was really young teaching the first writing course I ever taught, and teaching, that's when I first discovered James Baldwin's essay, Stranger in the Village, which was one of those life-changing things, which was similarly about realizing who you are as a person in the world. And he has a... he has a quote at the beginning, I think from James Joyce, that says something like, people are trapped in history and history is trapped in them. And that had just never occurred to me before.
Wow.
And that sort of became a running motif for me. And the ways that that's true have really interested me.
I learned that lesson through 100 Years of Solitude, which it's funny that you could have written that as a review of the book.
Yeah, that's true.
So... how you talked about your ambivalence about community organizing. What is that about? How have you come to that?
Well, I find that when I get involved in community projects, groups, which I've done too much and really keep resolving not to anymore, and then I do again. But I find that what I share with those people is the sense of the vital importance of those issues and... caring passionately about those issues. It's not a difference in politics, but I'm really interested in how people think, in social psychology, in what makes people think and believe the things they do. And I feel that community activism is a lot about just doing stuff and insisting on particular things, and often alienating a lot of the people that I would really prefer to engage and just find out more about why they think what they do and engage them in those kinds of conversations.
Right. It's funny you should raise this. I've been... people who are activists and into organizing issues, oftentimes we have meetings, but we just don't... but we don't have times where we get together to just visit. Now, visiting is kind of a rural and certain kind of traditional urban, certain ethnic communities, where you just talk and everyone's voice is heard and everyone is kind of seen and observed, and you get a certain kind of depth. And I grew up in an environment where you, when a stranger came to town, and, you know, we were kind of an insular rural area, and there were lots of strangers who came to town, you talked to them. You visited, and there was no meeting, no agenda, no nothing to resolve, nothing to decide, and it does exactly what you're saying is missing. And I think we're missing it. Modernity wiped it out for the most part. It's a quality of regard for one another that we have largely lost.
I think it also depends on who the we is, and I guess I've always felt this split that often it's people outside of the world of activism that I really relate to the most in terms of talking about things, the way they think, the way they speak, and often people within the world of community activism that I relate to the least, except that they're the ones that I share this passionate feeling about certain particular issues.
Right. And I guess it's the capacity to hold on to a tight rope and thread of interest, at the same time being able to hold on to an expansive openness. And many of us have a hard time living that balance, but we're also not encouraged to. So I see how you're framing a slightly different point of view. And there is within traditional culture and within educated modern culture, there is a way in which we are invited into conversation that does have a little more of a focus. It's not so open-ended as tradition, as visiting, as what I was describing. And I think that may be more what you're pointing to.
Yeah.
So tell me, what would you like to go to next musically?
Let's see. What's my list? How about Breaths by Sweet Honey and the Rock?
Sure. And do you want to say anything about that? Why you brought it before or after?
I'll say it now. Before I ever heard this song by them, I had encountered a poem by a Senegalese poet named Birago Diop, who wrote the poetry version of this that this was based on. And when a friend died at age 33 many years ago, and I was asked to give the eulogy there, I read his poem and played this. And it's always, I used to obsess about death when I was younger, mm-hmm. and this, I just found a very comforting view of death, that the dead people are just everywhere.
Right. Listen more often to things than to beings. Listen more often to things than to the ancestor's breath. When the fire's voice is heard, 'tis the ancestor's breath. In the voice of the waters, those who have died have never left. The dead are not under the earth. They are in the rustling trees. They are in the groaning woods. They are in the crying grass. They are in the moaning rocks. The dead are not under the earth. So listen. Listen more often to things than to beings. 'Tis the ancestor's breath. When the fire's voice is heard, 'tis the ancestor's breath. In the voice of the waters. Those who have died have never left. The dead have a pact with the living. They are in the woman's breast. They are in the waiting child. They are with us in the home. They are with us in the ground. The dead have a pact with the living. So listen. More often to things than to beings. Listen more often to things than to beings. 'Tis the ancestor's breath. When the fire's voice is heard, 'tis the ancestor's breath. In the voice of the water.
And that was Sweet Honey in the Rock and Breaths. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Harriet Malinowitz. So since that early, that 20-something process of becoming consciously who you are and embracing a life that you wanted to live rather than the one you were handed that you didn't care for, how have you changed? What have you embraced? What have you let go of from that time where you kind of got yourself in focus?
Well, I was hugely impacted by school and by curricular experiences that I had, starting with women's studies, mm-hmm. and then from there actively pursuing race studies, labor studies, queer studies. Now I'm very interested in the Middle East, which is another story. But when I was, 23, I started an MFA program at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and I got completely sidelined there by women's studies. That was the great distraction. And I took my first women's literature course, and again, it was like James Baldwin's Stranger in the Village. It was one of those things that crystallized so much for me. Mm-hmm. And
what did it bring in focus?
Well, you know, it's funny. That was one of these really mainly white women's, you know, writers who were lost and refound. It wasn't totally white, but it was, you know, the whole idea that there were some very famous, very successful writers of the 19th century who we never heard of because they went totally out of print, aside from Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote the big bestseller. But so that was just a realization for me that there were things that a lot of things that I didn't know that were just left out. And I think I did a lot of questing to just mm-hmm. know things. I started taking a lot of courses and sitting in on courses, even courses that I wasn't taking, that had a huge impact on my life. And later on, I became an academic, and one of the great perks is just being able to sit in on all these courses of my colleagues. And I don't really know anyone else who has sat in on as many courses as I have. But so I continued to be a student, which I like being a student more than I like teaching, actually. But in preparing for classes, that's always a great research experience. Right. And I love that. I love putting together a syllabus and doing all the research for it so I could fill in so many gaps that I wanted to.
I imagine, too, you also become known when you sit in on other classes among students.
Yes.
As a professor who takes other professors seriously.
Yes.
And how has that affected the way your students have regarded you?
Well, for one thing, students in those classes like to see another professor arguing with their professor about something.
Yeah.
And I've been told that by the professor who was teaching the class, mm-hmm. that it was really good for them to see how much we could disagree about things and what that conversation consisted of. In many ways I was learning things along with them, and in many ways I was older and wiser, you know, at the time, and mm-hmm. more mm-hmm. trained as a researcher and an academic. But I'm interested in students who are interested, basically.
Right.
I tend to be less interested in the students who were like me when I was young, just this totally oblivious, indifferent, you know, kind of way of being. The ones who really engaged me are the ones who were engaged.
Right, right. And that's true for most of us.
Yeah.
But you ran into something that opened you up.
Yes.
And those who are walking around, or some would say sleepwalking,
yes.
Through life, they haven't been woken up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Neat. So how have you grown suspicious of what you may have once held as a core value or core commitment?
Oh, a core value or a core commitment. Well, I mean, maybe going back to my favorite subject of the moment, Palestine and Zionism,
uh-huh.
and going back to what I said earlier about how I was raised.
And then rejected it.
And I rejected it not because I had any particular facts that proved them wrong. It was the way they talked about Israel in my community that I felt that there was just something wrong in the way they talked about it. They would say things and nod and smile and expected everyone to nod and smile back.
Right.
And it felt like there was a total absence of real critical discussion and thoughtfulness. I know now, I learned later, that most Jews were not interested in Zionism at the time that it evolved, and that there were other movements that were much more of interest to them. There was a lot of disagreement. Even within the Zionist movement, mm-hmm. there were the cultural Zionists who did not believe in political Zionism, who did not believe in statehood, who just felt that Palestine could be a world capital and magnet for Jewish culture, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but that other people lived there too, and that statehood should be shared if it was going to exist. They didn't talk about any of that stuff. It was just the complete absence of any countervailing discourse at all that made me think something's wrong here. And I have to say, it wasn't just on that subject. That was the culture that I was raised
right,
in.
Right.
They were not critical thinkers about anything. And so as I started to hear things about, well, Israel's bad to the Arabs, but I had no idea what that meant for a very mm-hmm. long time. But I did spend time in Israel when I was younger, a lot of it still oblivious, working on a kibbutz and mm-hmm. traveling around having fun in the sun. And
the last vapors of the leftist dream on the kibbutz oftentimes was that was... No?
Yeah, but you know what I found there was... people didn't talk to me about Zionism, and people didn't talk to me about the leftist dream. It was all about really having fun in the sun and, you know, planting tomatoes and then going down to, you know, at the end of the day to play backgammon in the kibbutz, you know, rec hall or something. And that, and, you know, seeing beautiful things, which there's no shortage of that kind of scenery there. And I had a lot of fun. And I've noticed that a lot of, like even these birthright trips and other tours that try to encourage young Jews to come to Israel, a lot of what they do is they have fun riding camels and floating in the Dead Sea, and you can lose track of the fact that there's really something else going on there.
Right. I sidetracked you, though. You were headed someplace else, I think.
Where was I headed?
On how you've grown suspicious of what you once held as a core commitment, and you kind of reflexively embraced Zionism, but it was it lacked complexity and it seemed dishonest. So you rejected it.
Well, when everybody tells you that something is true, you just accept that it's true up to a point.
And then they say it too much and you've got to let it go. I mean, so what did it look like when you rejected it, and what does it look like now? How has your attitude become more finely defined, or how has it changed in those, I'm guessing, 40 years?
Well, it's changed really radically to the point where I'm not one of these J Street, you know, two-state solution people. I really do feel, and I will say this without apology, that Zionism is racism. And I know how inflammatory that is
in
and how controversial it's been,
absolutely.
But I think it is. And I think that if you look at the details of it, if you look at the details of anything, there's a lot you just come to see. I certainly am angry at anti-Zionism being conflated with anti-Semitism, and virtually everybody that I know who does this work that I have any respect for and will actually work with fights anti-Semitism as well as Zionism and other forms of racism. So I think that's a red herring that's picked out all the time and used. It was created by PR firms, basically, that idea of changing the subject and calling everything anti-Semitic. But I think that the other night, I love Bernie also, and the other night Hillary and Bernie were debating, and he had the nerve to say this radical thing that Palestinians should be treated with respect and dignity and that the issue should be treated with some balance. And the fact that that was such a radical remark on CNN says something about the way this issue has always been discussed. But I have to say, you know, partly it was my involvement with other kinds of politics. Like, I was very involved with Central America in the 1980s and, you know, starting to see the U.S. role with other countries. I went to Nicaragua, where I actually had breakfast with Bernie Sanders one day in Managua at the Intercontinental Hotel, my brother Bernie and me, and in 1985. And, you know, I mean, I think that changed me. And then I started to read a bit. Ilan Pappe is a wonderful one of the new Israeli new historians, a Jewish who used to teach at the University of Haifa and started to write all these amazing histories. I don't know how many people know about the new historians in Israel, but basically... What happened was after the 1948 war, which Israelis call the War of Independence and Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe, there was a closure of archives for, I think it was 30 years. I think it was a 30-year rule, just as we have here about like JFK's papers and things like that. And at a certain point, they were opened up, and Israeli historians who were totally raised as Zionists and were believers went into the archives, and what they found was that the narrative that they had always been fed in school completely contradicted the primary sources that they encountered. And these sources were letters written by leaders like Ben Gurion and Chaim Weizmann, but also minutes of meetings by those early Zionist groups. All kinds of amazing documents. And so they, some of them, Benny Morris, Ilan Pappe, Avi Schleim, Tom Segev, who I like a lot, they all became known as the new historians as they started to publish books based on what they found in these archives, rather than simply repeating the history that had basically been generated by the very people who had fought the war of 48 and become the leaders of the country.
Yes, the winner is getting the right to write the history.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. So why is it so hard to separate anti-Zionism from anti-Semitism?
It's hard because of the work of PR groups who've been very successful.
But no, that's that. Why is it that their work is so easily successful?
Well, I think a lot of people in their feelings about Israel have deep, long-term, primordial emotional attachments. And it is very hard to often be critical of something that's that important to you. I don't know if you've heard the expression PEPS, P-E-P-S. It stands for Progressive Except for Palestine. Oh. And people who are very, who mm-hmm. have this great critique of everything else on earth, including racism and colonialism, mm-hmm. and suddenly a switch gets flipped when it comes to this subject, and they're saying exactly the stuff that they're critiquing other people for saying on every other subject. And I actually found that one of the big influences on my life was George Orwell and his concept of doublethink, okay. which came from 1984. And that's about the idea that somebody can hold two contradictory ideas at the same time and believe both of them. And 1984 is worth rereading and rereading, mm-hmm. which I've done. But just because of the way it portrays how people think and how a memory, an actual memory that they have, when contradicted by what the radio just said,
right.
How you can just snap to believe what the radio just said and mm-hmm. switch off what you remember.
Well, but that's talking about switching. One of the definitions of genius is to be able to hold two completely contradictory truths at the same time.
I don't think so. I think there's a difference between what Orwell calls doublethink and something that's like ambivalence or
paradox, hypocrisy, contradiction.
In being able to entertain the idea that there are paradoxes and to look at contradictions and analyze them. But with Orwell, it was not about analyzing them. It was about just something in your brain switching off and the other thing just wasn't there anymore.
Right, right. And so that's not holding it. That's just switching. So you're unitary at any moment. You just switch tracks.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
And that to me is we do that a lot human beings. It's a very common trait because we want to believe ourselves to not be hypocritical or not be paradoxical because we would in a sense melt down. It's like the problem that you were talking about growing up in Queens where they couldn't see the complexity and you, if anything, wanted the complexity because it gave it greater validity. That's a tough one, and in my own work, and the place I get the most pushback is I say, when we look at ourselves closely, we're all hypocrites. I have never met anyone who is not, now or in the past. I mean, it's a constant problem with mm-hmm. being human, and people push back on me harder on that notion than anything. Well, I'm not, or that person's not, or whatever. So let's play it a little more closely, and the point isn't to deflate or shame anyone, but rather to level our humanity.
And to look at that hypocrisy as an opportunity for learning something
yes.
about yourself as well as others,
yes.
instead of just backing off from it in fear.
Yes, and we are locked in such fear, and I think, you know, given what I've known about local demographics, we're a community that is 10 to 15% Jewish, mostly secular, non-religious. And that puts these issues in a particularly pointed way here in Tompkins County that they wouldn't be in other parts of the U.S. Mm-hmm. How long have you been in Tompkins County?
Just not quite 2 years. And I grew up in New York City.
Yes, yes.
I mean, in Queens. And then I later lived in Manhattan and thought there was no mm-hmm. place on earth to live except for Manhattan. And I still identify very much as a New Yorker. Consider
right.
when they talk about Israel as the Jewish homeland, I always say, no, New York is.
They're more there than anywhere else. That's another, yeah. Yeah.
And not just because there are a lot of Jews there. It's just it's because there are, and that's my model of a multicultural place where, you know, life is made safe for a lot of people. Obviously, it's not safe for everybody, but it's just a completely different model of how Jewish safety can operate.
Right, right. But I also, but I see here a lot of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And why is there so much more fear here, I think, than even in New York City?
I think partly because, you know, despite the fairly significant numbers of Jews here, it's not New York City.
Right.
It's that is not particularly the normative. Just the way you see the word schlep in the New York Times, that's just not part of normative discourse here in the same way. But the truth is, I don't know why they're so scared, and that's what I always really want to find out. And that's one reason why I felt frustrated working with some of the people I did on this issue. I felt like they didn't really want to listen and find out what was motivating the people that they were up against. And I feel that it's obviously something really powerful.
Right. And when it's powerful, there is a truth there of some sort. Otherwise, it wouldn't be powerful.
Right. Well, I guess there is. I mean, what is...
It could just be the nature of fear.
The status of truth is a big academic question.
Well, yeah, no, but I mean, it could just be the nature of exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And because there's a sense in which we, coming from a rural background, there is a sense of privacy and unfriendliness here that is not even like other parts of upstate New York. It's kind of a... This place grew demographically. We doubled in size since 1950. And that's when a lot of these demographic changes here happened. We're no more racially diverse than the state of Kansas. Mm-hmm. In fact, we're less mm-hmm. diverse than the state of Kansas, which a lot of people don't realize in
right.
Tompkins County. But where I'm trying to go with this is that Tompkins County and Ithaca has grown at a time when we have been the most wary of one another as a culture. In terms of our notions of privacy and conflating privacy with self-determination, and they're not the same.
Right.
And also the other narrative, which is its opposite, which is, universal whatever love, whatever the kind of the remnants of the protests and the hippie movements and stuff, and the communes that were throughout this area. So we kind of have an extreme going on here, and. I don't know what to make of it. I just kind of marvel at it, watching it unfold over time. You came here 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
What brought you here?
My partner, who has told me I'm not allowed to use her name on this show today for some reason, mm-hmm. so I'll call her Blanche.
Okay.
It's not her name for sure.
No.
But after I lived in Manhattan, I had moved to Park Slope in Brooklyn and was teaching for years at the most dysfunctional and dispiriting university in the world, Long Island University in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
It was a pretty sad state of affairs. And there were only two great things that they offered. One was their location, because being in Brooklyn, you're being at the crossroads of the world.
Yeah,
and in terms of the overused word diversity that you hear here, it was just as the signs say when you come from JFK Airport, welcome to Brooklyn, home to everyone from everywhere. And that's what it was really like there. And that's been one culture shock for mm-hmm. me being mm-hmm. here. But the other thing that they offered that was great was a wonderful early retirement plan. And finally, I got very fed up with the place for a variety of reasons. And I realized I could take it. And I took early retirement, and at that point I was living in Kingston. I had been doing a mega commute, Kingston, New York, down
wow.
into the city. Yeah, it was crazy. And meanwhile, I had met Blanche, quote unquote. And so on the weekends, Blanche and I were going back and forth. And during the week, I was doing my 3-hour each way commute twice a week to the city. I was totally exhausted. And I was ready to just settle down and be stable. And I had also moved from my feeling that there was no civilized place in the world except Manhattan to feeling like there was no place as desirable to live as the country. So we bought a house in Ellis Hollow, and I'm enraptured with that.
Wow.
And I moved here to be, with her. And once I got here, I didn't know what I was going to do exactly except work on a book I've been working on for a long time. And I ended up teaching in the writing department at Ithaca College part-time
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and getting very involved with women's and gender studies there, too. And that has been fabulous. They uh-huh. have been the antidote to LIU for me.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good, 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 good. So let's cut to music. What would you like to go for next?
Let's see. How about... somebody had introduced me to the Burns sisters here, who I'd never heard of before, and I just fell in love with them. And their song, Kill Kelly, it's so miserable, but I love miserable things like that. It just permeates
so
me,
we'll
and people have forced me to turn it off in the car when I've played it because it's too sad. But I think it's so gorgeous that I'd love to play. play
and
that.
And we'll play, it's a long song. We'll play a
play
portion
part of it. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And here we go.
Kilkelly Island, 1860, my dear and loving sunshine. Your good friend, the schoolmaster, Pat McNamara, so good as to write these words down. Your brothers have all gone to find work in England. The house is so lonely and sad. The crop of potatoes is sorely infected, a third to a half of them bad. Your sister Bridget and Patrick O'Donnell are going to be married in June. Your mother says not to work for the railroad and to come on home soon. Kilkelly Island, 1870, my dear and loving sunshine. Hello to your missus and to your four children. May they grow healthy and strong. Michael's got in a wee bit of trouble. I suppose that he never will learn. And because of the dampness, there's no turf to speak of. And now we've got nothing to burn. And Bridget is happy. You named a child for her. By now she's got six of her own. Well, you say you've found work, but you won't say what kind or when you will be coming home. Kilkelly Ireland, 1880. Dear Michael and John, sons, I'm sorry to give you the very sad news. Your dear old mother is gone. We buried her down at the church in Kilkelly. Your brothers and Bridget were there. You don't have to worry, she died very. That you might even come for a visit. Such
listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest is Harriet Mellinowitz. So, Harriet, tell me, what do you do on a regular basis to restore yourself intellectually, emotionally, physically? What do you do to kind of bring some balance or some order or whatever you want to call it? You pick the words that sound right. And also, when do you know you need to take care of yourself?
Well, one thing I do is read and read and read and read. And that is, I guess, my equivalent of what for some people is meditation.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And that helps me more than anything.
So when you read, what is the attitude with which you read? Because, I mean, and this is why I'm trying to, what I'm trying to do is what about reading is restorative to you?
Well, it's interesting because I read, because of the research I'm doing, the endless book I'm working on is on Zionism and propaganda. So I've been researching that for 10 years and probably will for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. But so when I'm reading these, you know, long, heavy tomes on the history of Zionism and things like that, I'm both excited because I'm getting information that I really want, and that's stimulating. But also, I realize it's just not the kind of language and worlds of feelings that have always been what really spoke to me. I've always loved novels my whole life.
Right.
And I kind of almost deprive myself of novels sometimes because I feel like I should just be strong and read the heavy, gritty stuff. And then when I do read a novel, or it doesn't even have to be a novel, it could be a memoir, I'm totally into narrative.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really not that into poetry.
Right.
Narrative is everything to me. I love movies too. And when I just read a great novel or a great memoir or other even nonfiction, creative nonfiction narrative, I just feel like something is happening to my endorphins. And I guess it's what people experience when they meditate. I just feel like this is what I'm alive for.
Right. What I hear you describing is when you submit to a text, you're not just reading it, but it's reading into you.
Mm-hmm.
And that quality is one that's like meditation. Mm-hmm. I don't hear people talk about it that way, but it's not compulsive reading. It's not reading for information. It's reading for a quality of delight.
Mm-hmm.
And from that delight comes observations and information and stuff, but it's rooted in that sense of wonder and delight.
And also great language. I mean,
yeah.
When the language is great, that's another problem I have with a lot of activism, you know, saying hey, hey, ho, ho, and chanting and,
right.
You know, saying yay with stuff at a rally that everybody agrees with just does not really do much for me. And
right.
I mean, I do it. I go to all of those things. But when I read some amazing language, I just read Maggie Nelson's book, The Argonauts, and
mm-hmm.
My friend Sherry occasionally just tells me something I have to read, and she's generally right. Mm-hmm. And she had gotten me into Hilton Alls years ago. And now into Maggie Nelson, and I just feel like I read these things, and I just feel like now I'm really glad I'm alive.
Yeah, yeah. A person comes to my mind that would be kind of outside your normal reading list, but she was the at one time she was the matriarch of Hebrew scripture studies among Christians. Her name was Phyllis Trible. And mm-hmm. And she taught at Union Seminary for many, many years. And James Meilenberg was her professor and trained a whole generation of scholars. His statement was, the proper articulation of form and content yields the proper articulation of meaning, which is the kind of succinctness I hear you seeking.
Exactly.
But she wrote a couple of books, one which are relevant to this conversation. One is God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality, where she shows how in the Hebrew language, the language does physically on the page what it says, by the way, particularly the poetry, by the way it's constructed.
Huh.
And when you look for clues into the meaning of the text, you have to see which words parallel each other in a way that create an enclosure or create an opening or create a certain kind of movement. And that is incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
She wrote another book called Texts of Terror, which is a book analyzing four passages of extreme violence against women and how can they be read from a feminist literary point of view.
Hmm.
And in a certain sense, redeemed.
Do you remember what she came up with?
She came up with lots of different answers, you know, because she's looking at it as a scholar. She's looking at it as a Christian and a Baptist. She had in presenting the book in worship at Union Seminary. I graduated from Union Seminary many years ago, but the year that she published that book, she led a series of worship services Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. We had 4 days, and each one was a different chapter. But the object sitting in that sanctuary was a cross with a woman on it, but the crossbeam had been lowered, and the woman's arms were tied above her head, and her feet were tied splayed apart on the bottom. And this was Christine on the cross. She had commissioned the artwork to go with this book of reading a Hebrew scripture, passages of violence against women, so we could juxtapose these narratives and juxtapose these images. And it's incredibly powerful. But I hear that kind of passion. And she loved the text and got this. In talking with you, I have a sense of the same quality of regard.
I'd like her.
Yes. And that's why I raised her name. It's also just for me, telling of one's teachers is an honor.
Yes.
So what do you do? What do you do more on the emotional or physical side of care for yourself?
Well, I walk a lot. I should say I'm really not a sports person. I'm not athletic. I'm a klutz, and I don't have a good sense of balance. I can't be in a yoga class where you have to stand on one foot. I would love to ride a bicycle around these country roads, but I live on one of the big biking roads out in Ellis Hollow, but I'd get killed in no time.
Yeah.
So what I do is I walk a lot. I hike and I walk. But I also realized at a certain point during my years in Manhattan that I wanted something more than anything in the world that even very poor people had, like in Appalachia, and that was a porch. And
you're going to visit yet.
and I realized that what I wanted to do with it was just what they do in Appalachia, which is just sit. And now I have one, and I can't even tell you how renewing and ecstatic it is. Yep. And I'm glad the weather has come back where I can do this. I also have a sunroom where I live now, too. So there's that feeling of being close to the outdoors, you know, any time of year. But it's being on a porch. It's the smells and the sounds and, you know, hearing peepers or birds. And just the smell of fresh air is so delicious. Mm-hmm. And I spend hours reading there. It's great when combined with coffee in the morning and wine in the evening and ice water during the day and supplemented by walks. It's just, that's my idea of how to live. I'm a real nerd, really.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. I mean, you know you need to get out. And my next question was actually going to be, how do you know that you need to start taking better care of yourself when you need to step out onto the porch or the sunroom or put away the work and read a novel? Or how do you know you need to, what happens in you?
Well, the problem for me is that I'm always guilty about seeking these pleasures. I mean, the expression guilty pleasures applies to most of mine, and I always feel like I should be doing something productive, even if it's just washing the dishes.
Right.
And and I know I got this from my father, who had a real depression mentality and believed that you should just do what you should to survive and not what stimulated you and not what interested you. And
Don't get too invested in it. Just do what you have to do.
Well, it was hedonistic. And he would talk about people who were philosophy or psychology majors as hedonistic. And it was a huge, huge struggle in my life to become an English major, which I didn't until after he died, actually.
Wow.
But I still feel guilty about pursuing these things that bring me joy and feel very noble when I'm, you know, doing something really gritty and necessary. And it could be as mundane as washing the dishes or doing the laundry, or a lot of the time it's doing activist work, and where I'm just not feeling that sense of pleasure that I have when I'm inhabiting the world of language and peacefulness in that way.
So how have you perpetuated this division that you don't like between getting satisfaction out of that which doesn't, I mean, feeling driven, getting kind of a perverse, this is what I need to do and this is my contribution, as opposed to this is my joy?
It's really hard. It's a never-ending struggle. As I said, I'm 61, and mm-hmm. I'm still dealing with it. And I think because my primary reality was this dichotomy between two parents, one who was cerebral and believed in joylessness as a virtue, and the other who was into warmth and family and connection and not particularly cerebral at all, I feel like I've lived out that dichotomy in a million ways. And it's one reason I always seem contrary to many people. I'm always saying, yes, but, whatever
right,
they say.
Right, right. But it's an earnest yes, but
it is. They don't always realize that. But.
Yeah. I mean, there's a sense in which your New York secular Jewish roots are very similar to rural, not small town, but rural America roots, because there's this yes, but quality and this contentious. That's just part of what's written into rural life.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and the kinds of the sitting on the porch in silence, the putting the tips of the fingers together on your lap, which is a traditional meditation mm-hmm. posture mm-hmm. in other cultures, other religions, mm-hmm. And being able to be quiet with one another and then pop out with some observation about politics or life or the bird that's playing in the water puddle down there or just whatever. And it all just kind of comes into focus. Just interesting.
Yeah.
So you brought with you some music to close with. You wanted, and it's Red Gum, the DM...
Diamantina Drover. Yeah, this is a song most of your listeners probably don't know. It's from Australia, and I didn't talk about this here, but I had a whole Australia period in my life from about 2000 to 2008. I was involved in a very long-distance relationship then, and I spent a lot of time there.
Traveling to Australia.
I spent summers there, my academic mm-hmm. summers there, and I spent my... sabbatical year there, and then my partner there at the time spent a lot of time here in upstate New York as well as Brooklyn, and this was a song that she introduced me to when I my first trip to Australia, and it reminds me of there's a lot of Celtic influence in a lot of Australian music, and it reminds me of those old Peter, Paul, and Mary songs that come from that Celtic background, and I don't know, I just love this song, and we used to sing it all the time.
So Harriet, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Likewise, thank you so much.
The faces in the photograph are faded, and I can't believe he looks so much like me. For it's been 10 long years today since I left for old Cork Station, saying I won't be back till the droving's done. Before the rain ever falls on the dusty Diamantina, the drover finds it hard to change his mind. For the years have surely gone, like the trains from Old Cork Station, and I won't be back till the droving's done. It seems like the sun comes up each morning, sets me up and then takes it all away. For the dreaming by the light of the campfire at night ends with the burning light of day. For the rain never falls on the dusty Diamantina, drover finds it hard to change his mind. For the years have surely gone, like the drays from Old Cork Station, and I won't be back till the droving's done.